What a joy to be with you and to celebrate this day. I wonder if 20 years ago, Dick, you could have sung that song, The Greatest Commands. I mean, I don't know, the 33 of you might have been able to do that, but what a joy 20 years later to feel the spirit of all of you who have gathered for the celebration and for worship today and as part of this congregation and its ongoing work. People ask me at Lipscomb University, what does it mean to be a Christian university? And that's not the focus of our conversation this morning. But I do say this in response. I say, well, we want to be Christian intentionally. We want to be Christian courageously. And we want to be Christian graciously. And I could preach a sermon on each one of those words, but I think every one of them would reflect our Savior. I think every one of them would be godly to say that this is not an accidental thing we're about. It's something where in this world that is so secular, we want to be courageous. And as a people, we want to be gracious. Not always an attribute that people would have attributed to us, but we want to be gracious. And as Ron and I are here this morning, it's obvious that those perhaps are not the same words you use. But those words, I think, are in the DNA of this community as we've experienced it. Intentional, courageous, gracious, walking out the sense of faith as you are doing. I forgot to call, and I didn't really know how to dress this morning. And sometimes I call and ask the question, and it really clears some things up. Because, you know, in our churches, that's become kind of interesting. We kind of have now tie churches and no tie churches. And I look at you and you're just confused. You know, I mean, here's Dick all dressed up and Jim didn't even have a tie on this morning when he read scripture. And I was at a church the other day that I knew was a no tie church, and I got there and everybody had a tie on. And I knew it was a no-tie church. I mean, it just had a reputation as that. And I got there, and everybody's all dressed up. And I said afterwards, I said, you know, I kind of thought this was a no-tie church. They said, we are. And I said, well, everybody's all dressed up today. They said, yeah, we heard you were coming. And so they were gracious to dress up, I guess. Well, we want to think for just a couple of moments about a passage of Scripture that on its face has absolutely nothing to do with today. But I think if we dig down just a little bit, we'll find it has everything to do with who you are. It is the Easter story, and the Easter story obviously is one that we focus upon maybe once a year in particular, but it really is the essence of who we are. Because if we don't rally around the fact that Jesus rose, our faith really doesn't hold together. And so I want you in this story, if you only remember three things today, I want you to remember three little words, and those words come out of this story, and they describe so well who I think you are and who I think you seek to be to the community, just like I think they describe who we seek to be as a university and seek to share with the community. Now, I know the Easter story is just not this time of year, but it's been on my mind. I was driving last Easter down one of the byways in Nashville, and it was Easter Sunday morning, and there was a restaurant that had a sign, and I thought it was fascinating. Just a little kind of cubbyhole of a restaurant, and here was this kind of sign out, you know, the one you can put the black letters on, and so you can send messages to those that drive by. And it said this, "He is risen!" Exclamation point. Hamburger steak and potatoes, $5.99. And I thought, isn't that fascinating? He is risen, the greatest moment in the history of all of humankind. And right afterwards, hamburger steak, $5.99. That was their special that day. Well, go with me back to the moment. Go with me back to the moment where Jesus now on that Friday has been crucified. And his followers are completely confused. They're extraordinarily frustrated. They're disappointed. They're heartbroken. This was not the way it was supposed to end. In fact, for most of them, the end would be triumph. The end would be glory. The end would be a moment where Jesus finally took the leadership of this world, and all of a sudden, instead of doing that, he's crucified on a cross. I don't know what it was like that Friday night as it got dark and as the body was taken down. And Joseph said he had a tomb, and so some must have worked to get the body into the tomb, and it was closed. And now Sabbath is coming, so nothing else can be done. But the story picks up on Sunday morning. The story picks up as two women go to that particular tomb. And I want you to remember these words as we get to them. The simple words, come and see. After the Sabbath, at the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him, they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the woman, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus, Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay." It's pretty easy for us to think about this as a historical moment and wrestle with what it meant then and to acknowledge that it perhaps occurred, and yet we so quickly dismiss it. And yet buried in that little story is this invitation, come and see. Come and see what? Come and see the greatest miracle that has ever happened in the history of humankind. Now, when I go back and try to focus on that, I've got to admit I can't explain it. And as a very analytical lawyer, the things I can't explain trouble me. And I know that through the ages, lots of people, even those in theological circles, have tried to explain it away. Well, his body was stolen. No, he really didn't die. And they come up with all of those explanations. And yet there were close followers who felt so real about this moment, they gave their lives in that belief. And it seems to me that we are constantly faced with things we can't explain, and yet that doesn't mean they're not very real. Not long ago, I lost my cell phone, and so the university bought me a new iPhone. I don't know how many of you have these, but they are amazing little devices. And every one of them is like a cup of Starbucks coffee. You can have it any way you want. So you put all these little apps on, and it becomes your iPhone and your way to get along in the world. And so every one of those little boxes means something, and yet I have no idea how it works. I have no idea how it works. I have no idea how I could be at home at my house on Franklin Road in Nashville this morning, and I could punch in a little thing here that talked about the Highland Hills Church of Christ, and it led me all the way here. And when I decided to go get a donut before church, I tricked it because I went a different way, and it found me. And it found me and brought me back. How does it do that? Or there's one on here called Shazam. Anybody have that? I can actually take my iPhone, put it up to the radio of my car. It will tell me what song is playing on the radio, who recorded that song, who else has recorded that song, and if I'd like to buy it for 99 cents, I can get it from iTunes. Can you tell me how that works? I don't understand it. Or we're in Barcelona, Spain, not long ago, and Rhonda wanted a cup of coffee. And I don't know where Starbucks is in Barcelona, but I have my Starbucks app on my iPhone. And I thought, this'll test it. So I press Starbucks, and in a matter of seconds, all of a sudden there's a map to a Starbucks about 3 blocks away. How does that work? Well, now, some of you are engineers, and you can try to sort all that out. I'm a lawyer, don't understand it, and yet it's very, very real. And so we come to this moment with the resurrection of Jesus. We come to the reality that it is the pivotal moment in our entire faith. The Apostle Paul says, if this didn't happen, we should be the ones who are pitied for our belief. It is a pivotal moment in Christian faith. And the invitation from the angel at that moment is to come and see. Well, my sense is it's not just historical. That the idea of God breathing life back into His people, the idea of God taking those of us who in moments experience death and bringing life back into us, in reality, resurrection is not just a historical event, it continues to happen. In fact, think about your own lives and think about the reality that we experience little deaths, but then we see resurrection in that. When I was a little boy, I experienced death when I was about 13. Well, not the kind of death you're thinking of, but it was the only day, the only year I played Little League. And I was the oldest year there. I hadn't played before, so I had this tremendous disadvantage, and I was an absolutely awful Little League player. And there was a moment there that reminded me about how awful I was as a baseball player. It came at the end of the season, where the very last game, after the last game, the coach calls us all together, and he passes out this sheet of paper that had every child listed on it and our batting averages for the season. And of course, you grab that paper, you start looking down for your name, and my name was at the very, very bottom. My batting average was 0.000. Now, it wasn't that I didn't get on base. I learned that if you kind of leaned across the plate, they'd hit you. And so I had an extraordinarily sore left shoulder at the end of the season, but they would hit you and I would get on base, so I could be engaged in it, but I never got a hit all year long. And when I read down that list, I just experienced a little death. The worst kid on the team. And yet God, in His marvelous sense of humor at times, in His marvelous sense of bringing life back to us. Well, it was 2 years ago that I find it ironic. I was president of the Atlantic Sun Division I Athletic Conference. I was president of the athletic conference we're in that is Tennessee and Georgia and North Carolina and Florida. I was president of the conference for 11 different universities and their Division I athletic play. You got to laugh a little bit about that, don't you? I didn't tell anybody. I didn't want them to know, but I thought, God, thank you for a little bit of life after a death way back then. A number of years ago, I graduated from law school, and after law school, one of the things that we lawyers have to do is take a bar exam. And it's an extraordinarily public moment when they announce the results of who passed and who didn't. My entire class took the bar exam. I'd gone to Seattle. Rhonda came up to see me. She heard the result before I did. And there in the hotel room where she traveled up, because I was already up there working, I opened the door, and she didn't need to say a thing. It was obvious on her face. I had failed. I failed. 3 years of study, all the work, actually working at a university where everybody would know the results of this, and when the list came out, my name wasn't on it. Death. And yet the irony is, a few months later, Pepperdine University called and said, "We'd like to offer you a position. Come back home to Pepperdine where you went to school. Come back and teach at our law school where I was a professor for 19 years before coming to Lipscomb." You got to see God bringing life back to death. Sometime later, Ron and I had our first child, and then we hoped to have the second child. And there was the moment where the doctor said, "You know, you're pregnant. You have been for several weeks, but there's no viability at all. This is never going to develop into your second child. We'll go ahead and take it and end the pregnancy because there's no life there." And you experience a little death. And yet God gave us wonderful children, three of our own, and a foster son just kind of thrown in for extra joy in our lives. See, I think the invitation to come and see is not just looking back 2,000 years. The invitation to come and see talks about today as well. Every once in a while, people have something to say about how I manage Lipscomb University. We have a little over 5,000 students. That means about 10,000 parents. We have 36,000 alumni around the world. We have the Church of Christ. We have a number of folks that have some sense. They know how this should be done. And occasionally they write me or call me or email me with those expressions. And I don't want you to do that. And I used to get really, really frustrated trying to express, no, I know that's not right, and this isn't perfect, and we're not really good at that, but look at what's going on. Come and see. And I found a sense of peace by saying, come and see the faculty, first-rate folks from all over the world that are devoting their lives to your young people. Come and see. Come and meet and talk to them. Or come on Tuesday morning, we have the gathering and 2,500 students gather. Listen to them sing. Come and see. Or come and see as they come back from spring break mission trips. Come to the airport with me as I try to meet as many groups as I can and see them after 10 weary days bouncing off the wall as they come through the terminal, so excited about their chance to serve all over the world. Come and see. My sense is, God is at work among His people today. And then it seems to me that the invitation is not just historical and it's not just today, but it's also an anticipation of God continuing to work. Senator Bill Frist told a story at Lipscomb not long ago, and it's a story that so well illustrates what is happening here. He's, as you know, a world-class heart surgeon, a transplant surgeon, and he shared with us what happens on a night where he's called for that very, very particular duty. He said, I'll be home, I'll be asleep, and the telephone will ring. It's the folks at Vanderbilt, and they'll say, Dr. Frist, we have some surgery to do tonight. We have a transplant. He'll quickly get up and get dressed. There'll be a car there to pick him up. They'll whisk him to the Nashville airport where he will hop on a plane. And sometime within the next hour or so, he will land in some city. He'll be transported by ambulance to a hospital there. He'll walk into a room where there is someone who is clinically dead, but whose heart is still beating. And they will take the heart out of that person to transplant it into someone else less than 4 hours later at Vanderbilt. And they'll take that heart out of that person, the donor, and they'll literally put it in an igloo ice chest surrounded by ice. It will have nothing in terms of warmth. It will have no feeling. It will have no pulse. It is just sitting there as still as it can be, surrounded by ice in an igloo ice chest. And he'll say, we'll go by ambulance back to the airport. They'll fly us back to Nashville, pick us up by ambulance at the airport, rush us to Vanderbilt, and we'll get into that suite where they have prepared the person who's going to receive that heart. Knowing we have less than 4 hours to get this done, the entire team is ready and they will start working. And sometime later, when we're all absolutely exhausted, will be a moment that none of us can explain. The heart will have been put into the body of someone who also has no life. And then he says there's a moment where we all just kind of stand back a bit. And someone turns a valve and warm blood starts flowing into that cold heart. And he says as the heart warms up and feels that blood, it remembers what God called it and made it to do. And we'll be there in complete silence, staring, and then we'll see this quiver. And then we'll see it again and again. And pretty soon that heart starts beating, and the monitor is no longer flatlined, but it has that familiar kind of look to it. The reality is, none of us, no matter how brilliant we are, can explain what happens. We can go get it, we can bring it, we can transplant it, we can hook it up, but none of us can explain what happens when the heart remembers what God called it to do. And so he would say, come and see. Come and see what we can't explain as God brings life again into this person. Well, I was thinking about your church, and it seems to me that perhaps that's a phrase that is appropriate. Not a phrase that says, come and see because look at all we've done, but a phrase that says, God is at work here. And on this 20th anniversary of our experiencing that, our message to the world is to come and see. Come and see our young people. Come and see our mission trips. Come and see our sense to reach out to the community. Come and see the unity that we feel as we share in the bread. Come and see who we seek to be about. Come and see. God was at work then, and God is at work now. All of that happens because he lives. Because the reality of his resurrection, we are drawn together as his people in his community. Let's stand together and sing.